When news of this being's phenomenal genesis was first released to the world, a certain phrase was used that has, at varying times, been attributed both to me and to others. On the news flashes coming over our TVs on that fateful night, one sentence was repeated over and over again. The Superman exists and he's American. I never said that. I presume the remark was edited or toned down so as not to offend public sensibilities. What I said was, God exists and he's American.
Holy, oh, oh.
And welcome to the Spouter Inn. I'm Chris.
And I'm Suzanne.
And this time we're reading Watchmen by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons.
But before we get going, we wanted to just comment a little bit on some sad news that I know we're both feeling a lot. Lee Marichal, whose work we've talked about together and who was a guest for one of the bonus episodes of the podcast, passed away or took her journey to the next world. And we were feeling that really strongly in our own ways, and just felt right to say a couple words about it. And I think maybe we'll have some opportunities in the future to reflect more on her work and the kind of ripples her work and her life and herself has had. So I don't know how you feel about it, Chris, but she's on my mind.
I mean, I'm very sad about it. She had so much energy. I didn't know her nearly as well as you did, but she was just such a phenomenal force.
It is. There's all this stuff happening. You know, she, like I said, ripples. She's made a lot of ripples in the world. Those are not going to stop.
No, and it was really wonderful to see all the outpourings on Twitter. So many people talking about how important she had been for them, both as a writer, as an activist, as a mentor, as a friend, as just a delightful force in their lives.
And tough, man. She would not hesitate to tell you if you were wrong.
No, exactly.
In the most direct way imaginable.
I don't want to make it sound like she was all smiles and giggles.
Oh,
she
no.
was intense.
And yeah. And so, like I said, I mean, on the one hand, like, I know she's not in this world with us, but I can't think of her in the past tense. I just feel that ongoing effect and that ongoing spirit. Anyway, so I'm looking forward to a chance that we might have in the future to reflect more on her and her work.
Yeah. Is there any text of hers that you're particularly excited to revisit now?
Well, you know what I want to do is go through her writing and choose out something that I haven't read as carefully or thought about as much, so I can really feel that I'm finding some new parts of what she's given to us. So I'd really like to think about that together and come back to something that that I've only spent a little bit of time with that I feel like would be good for us to share.
I agree. That is sort of what I'm thinking right now as well.
Like maybe one of her fiction books, I was thinking that would be a different approach because we had looked at her nonfiction closely when we did Memory Serves.
That's true. Although I'm also curious about finally reading her book, I Am Woman, about Native perspectives on feminism.
I've been thinking about that too in her first book, Bobby Lee. It's another one that I'm thinking about too. But anyway, let's think about this together. And we're not going to have a hard time finding something to talk about. I'll say that.
No, indeed. Well.
Watchmen.
Well, Watchmen.
This has taken a long time for us to put this episode out. And I have to confess, a lot of it is on me. Part of it is real life. Like there was real stuff that was happening, especially the Aga Khan Museum exhibition that we had the pleasure of discussing with Melissa Morton in a recent bonus episode. But partly also, this book is a lot. I mean, I really enjoy it and I am so happy we're doing it. But it was really hard for me to wrap my head around.
Now, this was your first time reading the book.
Yeah. I mean, I'd heard about it and been really intrigued by it because I love counterfactual history. I'm just absolutely absorbed by it. And temporality in general is like one of the things I think about a lot. So it's you know, absolutely my flavor. But it was hard to keep all in my head. And I had this experience when I was reading it. I was like, oh, man, this is like Middlemarch. Not that the book is actually like Middlemarch. But that was a book, too. I remember when we did it together. I hadn't read it before. I really enjoyed it. Like it was giving me all kinds of ideas and putting together all kinds of things I'd thought about in different connections over a long period of time. But it was really hard for me to hold it, like to control it all at once. And this experience for me was very much like that.
Well, there is a lot to this book. I've read it a few times before, and I'm still astonished at how much there is of it, how much I didn't remember of it when I was rereading it. But just the level of detail as I'm taking notes on this, and just, oh my word, there's so much.
When was the first time you read it?
Oh, I probably read it first when I was a teenager or like college age, let's say. It's, you know, it's one of those books that people who don't typically read comics or especially don't read superhero books are likely to have read, right? Like there's Watchmen, there's Mouse, there's Persepolis, there's Fun Home, there's probably a few others, but this is definitely one of them. And so it felt sort of obligatory as part of, you know, a proper education to go track this down and read it. And I, you know, I like comics, but I do tend to not read superhero comics. So I come at this from that perspective, which this is a superhero comic.
Or, it's a very particular flavor of superhero comic, though.
Yeah, it's definitely playing with the tropes of superhero comics. And it's doing it during the 80s, which was when the comics industry, the superhero, mainstream superhero comics industry was going through a bit of a overhaul, as I understand it. You know, a lot of your dark and gritty reboots come from this era. And this is part of that, I suppose. But I don't feel like I'm much of an expert on that side of things. I just approach it as a text that is really appealing, I think, to people who are interested. Well, it's appealing on a number of levels. One of the things that I get most excited about is sort of the formal vivacity of it all. It's wild.
Visually, it's fantastic.
Visually, it's fantastic. Structurally, it's really smart. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of stuff going on. We'll try to get into some of that as well. Was there something in particular about it that really appealed to you?
I guess two things. One, as I mentioned earlier, the counterfactual narrative thing. I absolutely love that, this like, you know, alternative kind of reality, this alternative history, and also the ways in which timelines line up or don't line up. And then, of course, the figure of Dr. Manhattan inhabiting linear time in the very special way he does, right? I mean, that kind of stuff I absolutely love. But the other thing that absolutely enchants me about the book is, again, its visual quality. There are certain moments where it's like music, like it produces a really synesthetic, I think, kind of effect that produces awe in really neat kinds of ways. And that's the other thing I loved about it.
Well, let me give a little bit of background for it. Not too much, I suppose. The authors are Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. Alan Moore is a UK writer, most known for his comics work. Started working in the industry around 1980, got more and more known in the industry, was given control of a character named Swamp Thing and radically rewrote it and made it very experimental. And I'm led to believe, having read up on this, I haven't read Swamp Thing, but it's really, he did a lot of research into Louisiana where it's set and tried to bring that in, tried to, in that sense, make it more rooted in place, which is not a thing that was necessarily happening in superhero comics at the time. Although, again, I'm not an expert on that. After that, Watchmen came out 1986 to 1987. It was originally serialized, as you might imagine. It was a huge hit. He continued working in superhero comics. He did some notable runs with Batman and Superman, some of the biggies, as well as some more separate projects like V for Vendetta, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Promethea, From Hell, things that you may have heard of, things that movies have been made out of, including Watchmen.
For better or for worse.
For better or for worse. We may talk a little bit about the movie, we may not. We'll see. Dave Gibbons is the artist behind Watchmen. He's done a lot of work in the mainstream comics industry, but Watchmen's the only thing that that I could recognize when I looked over his CV. That's not a criticism of it. It seems like people like his work. I just don't know. So those are the two people behind it. I think we'll go over the plot, and then I think we'll get more talking about the context where this emerged, talking a little bit about the 80s.
Yeah. Before turning to the plot, one of the things that really struck me, you were saying a little bit about the form, and, you know, it's in 12 parts. And to some extent, that's just all real pragmatic. It was in 12 issues in 1986, 87. And that's just a sort of a normal kind of arc, right? But there's also, because this work is so preoccupied with time, it's also like the clock face we're always reminded. You know, time is ticking down to a particular moment. And that formal principle that I thought was really neat.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't think that there's a formal element to Watchmen that they didn't think about and try to enrich. All right. So there's a lot of plot in Watchmen.
There is a lot of plot.
And I guess spoilers if you haven't read it before, but it's fine. There's so much. Here's the basic gist of it. The main action, it takes place in the year 1985. But if you want to understand the 1985 of Watchmen, we have to go back to the 1930s and to the introduction of superhero comics. Now, imagine if instead of just reading about the thrilling adventures of Superman, which dates from 1938, and The Batman from 1939, ordinary citizens, instead of just reading, just started dressing up as heroes and fought crime vigilante style and got a lot of celebrity for doing so. But, you know, they're just ordinary people in costumes. They don't have any actual superpowers until 1959, when a physicist named John Osterman gets dissolved in a nuclear experiment at a government facility and somehow manages to piece himself back together atom by atom. He is given the name Dr. Manhattan, and with his ability to manipulate time, space, and individual atoms, he becomes a major tool of the U.S. government and is deployed by President Richard Nixon to win the Vietnam War and to threaten the Soviets in the Cold War. So caped crusaders continue crusading, but the public grows increasingly anxious about their vigilantism. After all, who watches the Watchmen? So in 1977, an act of Congress outlaws superheroes, and most of the superheroes retire. But not all of them. We begin in 1985 with Rorschach, so named because he's got a splotched mask that entirely covers his face like a Rorschach test. He never quit crusading. He's too disgusted by what he sees as the evils and perversions of the world to ever give up the fight, and he's too willful, independent, and antisocial to be told what to do. He investigates the death of the Comedian, another superhero, and begins to suspect that someone is trying to kill all superheroes. But who? And the evidence suggests that maybe he's right. There's an assassination attempt on a hero-turned-businessman named Ozymandias. A reporter ambushes Dr. Manhattan with evidence that he's caused cancer in everyone who spends time around him, and the stress of that causes him to just up and leave Earth to chill out on Mars for a while. And even a supervillain named Moloch is killed. But that's as part of a trap to catch Rorschach and throw him in jail. Now, the question of who would want to kill masked heroes allows the book to explore the incredibly fraught relationship these characters have had with each other, and with the public, and with the course of history over the past 50 years. But it also ends up being just a subplot to what's really happening. Ozymandias has an elaborate plan to create a massive, realistic space alien and to teleport it into the middle of Times Square on midnight on New Year's Eve, killing countless people and making the world think that they're being invaded by aliens and that they all need to work together to stop the incoming alien invasion. This, he thinks, will end the Cold War and lead to world peace, because now all the different countries have to work together. Makes sense, right? The only reason to kill the masked heroes was to prevent them from spoiling the plan, because if anyone figures out the aliens are fake, then we're back to staring nuclear war in the face. The book ends with Ozymandias' plan seemingly successful, but liable to be completely undone, as Rorschach's diary, with all the details he's learned about the plan, has been discovered.
Man, that's a lot of plot.
That's not even like a third of the plot. But that's some of the big overarching things. I hope that was at least coherent if anybody listened to this without having read the book before.
No, I think it's really a good summary, because when I was having a hard time keeping all the pieces in my head, getting your account really helped me to anchor myself and then be able to navigate the whole structure. And in part, I think it's because, you know, while some people I think are really educated in the sort of comic or graphic novel layout and are very comfortable with it, like I'm newer to it. And so I'm still really finding my feet with that layout, even though I find it really, really interesting. But also the temporality, like you just get thrown into a different moment with no cue a lot of the time to let you know where you are. But once you realize things like, for example, that of these various superheroes, some of them are kind of the second of their kind, so to speak. So for example, we're introduced pretty early on to a character who's Night Owl, but he's the second Night Owl. This is Daniel Dreiberg, right? He's the second of two Night Owls. So on the one hand, the superhero has an individual identity, but on the other hand, there are, I don't know what to call it, performers or people who play the part. And so that disconnect between the human beings and the superhero role they inhabit is a really important part of the structure from the very beginning.
Yeah, and as you say, it can be real shifty. There's a lot of very quiet or subtle, or let's say cinematic, changes in scene dissolving from one time period to another through, let's say, zooming in on a photograph, things like that. And then suddenly you see the scene that the photograph takes place in. It's a little bit tricky if you don't yet have a sense of who all the different characters are. And there are a lot of characters.
Yeah. That photograph moment you mentioned is one that I found particularly beautiful and particularly effective. It's from book four, I think, when we're getting Dr. Manhattan's backstory, where he's got this photograph in his hand and he's reflecting on how he'll drop it in a few seconds, in 12 seconds. He hasn't done it yet. So there's this weird kind of temporality of the time between when he says he's going to drop it and the time he actually drops it. But then there are all these like memory holes kind of that we go back down into with him, into all these moments in the past that tell us how he got where he is now. And so that's, I think, a particularly beautiful example of that rapid shifts between one time frame and another, but all held together through the photograph.
Yes. I think we'll talk more about that in a moment. But that is a really remarkable chapter and remarkable passage in the book.
It's really beautiful.
Yeah. Before that, though, I want to set a little more context about when this book came out. I mean, this is a book that is obsessed with power run rampant. It's obsessed with the impending apocalypse, with the Cold War reaching a boiling point, if that metaphor makes any sense. It's very 80s. And it's very much about the Reagan era where it comes from, even though Reagan is nowhere to be found, because in this universe, Nixon won the war and is still president 10 years later.
Yeah, it's a strange moment. I've been reflecting about this because, you know, you and I inhabit slightly different points in that timeline, right? We're 10 years apart, right? So both of us, I think, remember the Reagan era. Both of us remember the Cold War dimension. But in my mind, there's a sharp distinction between the anxieties of the very last stages of the Cold War, which for me were more in the 70s. Like, I remember being in school and being very anxious about, you know, the likelihood of the end coming. You know, I remember that being an issue more in the years before 1980, and the Reagan years, which started in 1980. I remember those as being tense, but having a sense of things were moving, stuff was happening, as opposed to the sort of stagnancy I remember perceiving in the very late 70s.
That's interesting, because in the mid 80s, when this book would have come out, I was living in New York City, going to school in Manhattan every day, and just looking out the bus waiting for the bombs to come on me, like assuming I would see them as I came in. Like, it did not seem plausible that we would make it out of the 80s. Now, some of that might just be an age thing, right? Like, I was a young teenager then.
Yeah, in those very same years, I was, you know,
college age or so.
Oh, I was post-college living in New York and, you know, it's a lot of booze and drugs as well.
Sure, there's that.
So things looked better, you know, in a sense.
I suppose so. You also had a certain amount of agency, I imagine, and a sense that you could do something about it.
Yeah, no. I had just gotten out in the world.
Yeah. Whereas what could I do? Like, no. My parents weren't activists. We weren't out trying to make a difference about that sort of thing. I was just waiting for it to come, waiting for the bomb to drop.
But this sense of imminence, you know, it's not the same as the anxieties of the present moment, but there's a kind of resonance. You know, now it's centered on things like climate change and economic collapse.
Yeah.
Right? But I feel a real resonance between some of the stresses of that time and this time.
Yeah, exactly. But there's something so... The threat of nuclear war, or at least as I remember it from the 80s, was notable in that it felt like it was something that could happen at any second and would be very fast. And climate change feels like it'll, you know, even though it's imminent, it feels like it'll still take a few years for it to really, like, it'll get worse slowly and slowly, and maybe it'll pick up in speed, but it won't be like over in a day or two, like the nuclear war would have been.
No, absolutely. You know, I totally agree with you in making that distinction. There's this one visual moment. Actually, it happens twice. It happens once, and then there's an echo of it in book 12. In book 4, with Dr. Manhattan's backstory, we get the image, a really striking visual image of him when he gets dissolved in that chamber. And for me, that was like very triggered real anxiety and really brought me back to that period of time when I was really anxious about nuclear war. You know, I don't know why that image had that power for me, but it really struck me that way.
Well, part of it, I think, is that it looks like, you know, it's taking up 2/3 of the page. Mm. It's a 3x3 grid, generally speaking. And so this is taking up the bottom 2/3 of the page. Mm-hmm. And it is an image of his, of John, of Dr. Manhattan to be, of his arms stretched out. And you can see it's very black and white, except for his eyes, which are yellow. And you can see his skeleton and then sort of like a giant, it looks like the gentle arc of a nuclear cooling tower of like his bits flying away from him. It's not sort of visceral, but it's very haunting. And it looks like the sort of shadows on the wall that you might have associated with nuclear blasts. It's a really haunting image.
Yeah. No, it really produced a lot of emotion in me, exactly of the sort you were describing.
I think the other thing that I was thinking about with the notion of the speed of nuclear war, as it felt to me in the 80s, was the way that this book is all structured, as you said, around sort of the clock. Like, the big apocalyptic moment of the book's end is at midnight New Year's Eve. And there's a sense of marrying that idea of the apocalypse at midnight with the nuclear clock, right? This metaphorical clock that has been going around where, you know, it's 5 minutes to midnight. Like, how close are we to a nuclear war, a nuclear apocalypse? And the idea of the time clicking ever forward in a matter of, I mean, the plot takes place over more than a few hours, but there's real temporal urgency, and the book is structured around the temporal urgency coming towards the midnight, but also this exploration of what time is like from the point of view of Dr. Manhattan, especially as a character who lives both within and outside of temporality as we know it.
Yeah, the book really produces this incredible tension between linear time and other ways of understanding time, which could be cyclical, could be eternal in the sense of all times being at one time. There's this really weird stuff going on. So each one of the 12 books gives us an image of a clock face where we're getting with each book closer and closer to, you know, 0 hour, to midnight. So there's that sense of a countdown. And of course, that's what's going to climax with this catastrophic plot that Ozymandias has made, which is going to happen at midnight in Times Square on New Year's Eve, right? So there's this incredibly linear sense of time rushing onward. But there's also this totally other sense of time, which we get especially in the narrative around Dr. Manhattan, but we also get in scattered ways across the whole text in the way that different moments in time are juxtaposed one with another, and generations are juxtaposed in a really particular kind of way. So that's really worth thinking through carefully. So that's part of the tension of the book, that we've got a sense of linear time and urgency and rushing forward, but we've also got this weird sense of multiple times coexisting in one moment. And there's a bunch of examples for that.
Yeah, there's a sense in which all of these characters, all of the superheroes, both retired and even dead and you know, or still active, are traumatized by their past. That a lot of their personality comes from or is molded by what has happened to them in the past. And so in order to understand where they're at now, we need to understand a lot of what's gone on during the last 50 years. And so the book is structured that we meet characters and then we get a chapter for each one, basically, of their backstory. And yet this is all happening sort of at the same time. It's really woven in together to highlight the idea that their past is also their present, is also their future, which, you know, you can overlay that in a comics page in a way that is much trickier to do in a novel.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, you know. I was thinking about, on the one hand, comparing the ways in which you can manage timelines in a graphic novel or a comic like this one, as opposed to the ways in which you can manage it in a novel or other kinds of prose, but also the ways in which you can manage it in film. And that was really interesting to think about. There's some things that the graphic novel lets you do that none of those others allow.
Yeah, I think the thing that the graphic novel allows is a kind of simultaneity, right? Is that you have a page or you have a panel in which several things are going on at different times. They do a lot of that here. There's some really remarkable stuff. There's a whole side plot, which I don't really want to get into, of a comic that is in this world where superheroes are real. Superhero comics don't get big, but instead pirate comics do. Mm-hmm. And so we get scenes from this really, really lurid pirate comic that one of the minor characters is reading.
I could not even wrap my head around that. I was like, that's a whole nother level.
It is a completely, completely extra slice of this seven-layer dip. Whatever. That's a weird metaphor. But it's completely above and beyond. But the level of resonances between what's going on in the lurid pirate story, what's going on around the person who's reading it, and what's going on in the overall plot at that moment are dizzying at certain points. And the page makes it really easy to show three different things at once. You can see the person reading. You can have a text balloon in the piratey font with a little piratey background. You can have people walking by overhearing it. And you can also have, like, on the same page, but, you know, a few frames later, you can have a visual echo of something happening at another time and place entirely. Mm-hmm. But they're still, you know, able to be seen with your eye at the same time in a way that you can't do as easily with, you know, the lines of a novel, with a linear, you know, two paragraphs on the same page of a novel. You don't take in the same way as two panels on a page of a comic.
Yeah. Part of it has to do with the quickness with which you can kind of capture synoptically what's happening in a panel. You know, that's very different from the experience of reading prose where you're, it's slowing you down always. You have to make your way through it. I have a kind of a nice example of a very simple version of what you're describing. And this is in the Dr. Manhattan backstory. For those who have the deluxe edition, it's page 127. And for those who just have the comic page numbering, it's chapter 4, page 17. And there's a whole series of blocks where we're like in different moments. So on these two facing pages, in 1959, these things happen. In 1963, an hour into the future, her sweat cools and dries in the November bedroom. It's 1964. I'm informing the Pentagon. No, no, no. It's 1966. In 1985, in 1966, we're like popping between all these different moments that are being flagged as different points in his timeline. But the effect of that isn't just the juxtaposition. It's also to give us a sense of where he stands in time, which is everywhere. At the end of that page, he notices that his partner, Jane, is aging more noticeably every day. He says, "While I'm standing still." So he kind of stands outside of time, even at the moment he's giving us a sense of many, many, many points in time. And that's something you can do in the graphic novel. I have no idea how you could possibly do that in any other medium.
Yeah, no, that is a really striking page or page and a half where, like you said, several of those captions, you know, it's 1964, it's 1966, those are in the same panel. Mm-hmm, like we're going really quickly through this timeline.
Boom, yeah.
And he's not changing at all in this reflection of how, with his godlike powers, he has transcended age and is outside of while still living through time. Mm-hmm. She gets much older over the course of a page because 10 years have passed and she's a normal mortal and she's much older now. It's an astonishing effect. And, you know, I was thinking while reading this about Orlando, which was the last book we did, even though it was a few months ago now.
Let's think back to that. But no, it is very similar in some ways.
Yeah, to that last chapter of Orlando where time is flying by. And Orlando is also sort of outside of time, not quite the same way as Dr. Manhattan, obviously, but it's still sort of, you know, ageless and just zipping through time and not being affected terribly by it, except how it is affecting her. And Virginia Woolf does a fantastic job expressing that, but she can't have access to all the tricks and tools that we find in Watchmen.
No, that's exactly right. And one of the things that's really striking about this figure of Dr. Manhattan, who we might talk about in more detail if we want to, is that in some ways he's kind of inhabiting in a much more substantial way the role that you would think Ozymandias should have, right? Because Ozymandias is the one who has this big megalomaniacal plan to take over the world. He sees himself as a kind of another Alexander the Great, right? So he's the one who should sort of be standing in the position of the person who transcends time, only he totally doesn't.
Yeah. It's not even that he's trying to take over the world. He's trying to save the world from the nuclear war that's about to happen.
Well, that's what you always think you're doing, right?
Well, exactly.
From all these movies.
What did you think of that? I know you have a fondness for apocalypse narratives.
I love apocalypse narratives.
Yeah. And so this is an apocalypse that sort of both brought on and prevented by somebody on their own.
Yeah.
How does that compare to some of the other apocalypse narratives you've enjoyed?
Oh, gosh. You know, gosh, I don't even know where to begin. So, you know, we were talking before about the anxiety around nuclear war that people felt through the whole Cold War period and our own experiences of that in the 70s and 80s. And for me, that whole time is inextricably tied up with a childhood where, because my mom was a Jehovah's Witness, you know, I also was a Jehovah's Witness, where there was also this belief that the end of days was at hand and it was expected to come any minute in the late 70s. And so for me, the anxieties around nuclear war and the anxieties around the end time that we should be looking forward to, you know, within that faith community, those are kind of inextricable. And so for me, thinking about apocalypse in a way that was simultaneously a mood of expectation and a mood of dread, like, that's so hardwired. And so something like this text really just really pushes all my buttons, right? Because we know it's coming right from the very beginning, just about, right? And we've got this sort of drumbeat, you know, of book by book, and we're getting up to 12. That's going to be the big number. And when we get there, we're in a singular historical moment, right? This apocalyptic moment. But it's also a moment that's looking back to all these other historical moments in time that are also apocalyptic in some way. So the big full page layouts of the opening of chapter 12, they're so amazing. They're doing such incredible work, giving us that clock face pointing almost at the number 12 and then at the number 12. There's an image of a poster for Madison Square Garden, Pale Horse, sold out. But that's meant to remind us of the pale horse of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse in the biblical book.
Playing with a band called Kristallnacht.
I was just getting to that on the next page, right? Playing with a band called Kristallnacht, right? So that gives us a connection to that historical moment, apocalyptic in its own way, right? Mm-hmm. And then on the facing page, the movie marquee for The Day the Earth Stood Still, again, putting us into another sort of cinematic moment of apocalyptic thinking. And the pages are littered with bodies in this intensely beautiful and also horrible hot pink color palette. You know, and I look at this and I'm like, wow, this is like just pushing every single apocalypse button I have. So that's really, really, really powerful, right? The fact that you anticipate it all along doesn't make the payoff any less overwhelming.
One of the things about the payoff is that, I mean, in a certain sense, if you back up a moment, if you look away from the page and think about it for a moment, it's a very silly thing that has happened, right?
Yeah, it's a fake apocalypse.
It's a giant octopus. It comes straight out of old 50s movies, like The Day the Earth Stood Still. Mm-hmm. But it's real. Like, even within the fiction, the, you know, in those movies, I've seen so many of them. See my other podcast for details, I guess. Mm-hmm. But in those movies, you know, it's like always happening in a small town. The number of people who die, if anyone dies, it's very limited in its effect. Like, you don't actually see Manhattan, the middle of Manhattan getting destroyed and thousands of people dying in a massive amount of lurid carnage like you see here. Mm-hmm. So taking something as fundamentally silly as the giant octopus and then showing it having a tremendous devastating effect is fascinating. And also, of course, plays off what's going on in the entire book of looking at, you know, comic book heroes, which many people will look at as silly kid stuff. And really digging into, like, what is the psychology of a superhero? What would it mean if superheroes walked among us? Let's see what happens if we make this more realistic in a certain sense.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's digging into all kinds of cinematic history, like the octopus, terrifying octopus apocalyptic figure, but also little subtle things like in the second to last of the full page spreads, one of the signs we see sort of broken and hanging down is a sign for the Promethean cab company bringing light to the world, right? Which is both, yeah, I know it's great, right? It's a shout back to sort of the myth of Prometheus and the whole idea of stealing fire from the gods and going too far and transgression and so on. But also it's, I think, also got to be pushing our Frankenstein button, right? You know, so that we think about that whole going too far, penetrating the secrets of nature, trying to create something that no human being should be trying to control, both in terms of like that literary history, but also the cinematic history, right? So all this stuff is going on. So it's so overdetermined, right? By the time we get to this climactic moment.
Yeah. And the Promethean Cab Company is a place we've seen before earlier. Some of the minor characters work there. Like, we have a bit of an emotional connection to it, although it's very...
It's a real thing.
Subtle. It is more subtle than just having one of your characters mauled in a close-up. It's just a small detail on a very busy page that brings you back to the rest of the characters that you've met along the way.
Yeah, no, it's kind of amazing. So we haven't talked too much about the characters. We've been talking about the shape of the narrative and like the time parts of it, which are like, I could talk about all day long. What do you think about the characters? Like, are there any that you empathize with, or like, did you feel the characterization was like, were you being brought into either empathetic or negative relationships with any of the characters?
I think that one of the trickiest things about this book for new readers is that all the characters are miserable.
Yeah.
It's
pretty dark.
They're all really unpleasant in different ways. Some of them are unpleasant in ways that kind of win you over, but then you like, oh no. Like Rorschach, you know, sometimes comes off as admirable, fighting the good fight and so forth.
And other times a psychopath.
And is a complete psychopath, and his moral compass is completely broken in many ways.
But he's terribly harmed, and you know, that's part of his formation too, right?
Exactly. He is a traumatized character who is deeply broken and yet is doing the right thing sometimes and is doing the wrong thing other times. Mm. He is a compelling character in many ways, but he's a really unpleasant character.
Yeah. One of the things about him that strikes me so much is exactly, you know, his mask face, you know, the Rorschach face. Because there are moments, it looks different in different images on the pages of the graphic novel. At certain times, you almost get like, I don't know if you noticed, it's like a kind of a Batman kind of shape. And I was thinking about the ways in which, you know, he kind of almost epitomizes the two sides of the superhero figure. And I wondered if that's part of that like 1980s rethinking the superhero kind of thing you were talking about before.
I think that's part of it. I mean, I definitely think that the idea that he's got this special fabric on his face where the pattern changes all the time, like it's meant to be this new technology type thing. But I think it definitely is meant to reflect his, you know, character as somebody who is shifty, let's say.
Yeah, it looks different at different times, right? Depending on where you are, right?
And is sort of unknowable, right? Like he's the one character, he's the one superhero where most of the other superhero characters don't know his real identity.
No, that's right. Like for a lot of these figures, we know their like person name as well as their superhero name. For him, we get it very belatedly.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a startling reveal when it comes about. Mm-hmm. I find Dr. Manhattan's character fascinating.
Yeah.
I find that position of being outside of time, but also living through it and wanting to have relationships with other people, but being less and less able to connect with them because of how you are living.
It's like Milton's Angels.
Yeah. It's really fascinating. And, you know, it doesn't make me want to like have a drink with him, but I definitely love reading about him and from his perspective. I think that's really fascinating. Also, I will say those two characters, those two of the main characters who are so different from the rest of the characters, it's also represented visually, right? Rorschach's handwriting is filled with weird lowercase capital letters and so forth.
And his diction is weird too, right?
Yeah. So his diction is weird, but also some of the letter shapes he uses are different. And you see that on the very first page, which starts with some of his journal and some of his thoughts where, you know, he'll use lowercase A's and E's where you would expect capital letters in the comics lettering tradition. And similarly, all of Dr. Manhattan's text is with a very light blue background. He's a sort of big glowy blue guy. And all of his speech is in speech balloons that have this faint blue glow behind them. And it's a very interesting, subtle effect, I think, but it highlights just sort of how otherworldly he sounds without having to overemphasize that in his diction.
Totally. And the way he gets introduced to us visually the first time, I was really struck by this. So this is, I guess this is chapter one, page 19 in the comic. So page 27 in the whatever this is, this deluxe edition. So we're getting to know Rorschach, right? And then we have this overleaf where we get this 2/3 of a page wide and full page up shot of Dr. Manhattan. All right, good evening, Dr. Manhattan. And he's this godlike figure, like the first time we see him. And I think that has such a powerful effect in determining how we'll see him all the way through. Like we'll get him in a much more humanized kind of way later, like in chapter four, when we get his backstory and there's that really poignant reflection on the photograph and stuff. It's quite moving, I thought. But the first time we see him is as this kind of otherworldly figure.
Yeah, he's massive. He's naked. He is light blue. He is several stories tall. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Rorschach looks up at him and says, good evening, Dr. Manhattan. I mean, sort of the next thing we see not too long after that, I think in the next chapter, is he's attempting to connect with his girlfriend and takes advantage of the fact that he has control of time and space to create multiples of himself in order to have a fun, kinky sexual encounter.
Yeah, which, that's weird. She's like, no, thank you.
Didn't warn her about this, didn't suggest it beforehand. She reacts very poorly.
She's like, ew.
As she's desperately trying to engage in his humanity, right? Not his magical powers, so to speak.
I laughed out loud at that part,
It's a good bit. But it's also like interesting how, you know, he's using what he can in her to try to keep the spark alive in their relationship. And she kind of just wants him to be normal and doesn't want to be reminded of all the things that he could be doing. You know, so it works on many levels, let's say. As everything in this book does, it's such a dense book.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that I just absolutely love about this is part of the incredible intricacy of the book is that, you know, he is or wanted to be a watchman. Like, in other words, his father was training him up to be a person who repairs watches. Mm-hmm. And there's this really pivotal moment that happens when his father's like, no, you must be a nuclear physicist instead. I guess as fathers do, and throws the watch pieces over the side. And that aspect comes back again in really important pivotal moments in Dr. Manhattan's narrative. So that idea of the watchman and the watchman is kind of intentioned in a really subtle little way because it's a way of thinking about time that's very, very material.
Yeah. And he builds that sort of clockwork structure on Mars when he's spending some cool downtime there. And, you know, he is a creator. He is in control of the very moments of time. And he is able to fashion something as intricate as himself out of the raw materials of the world. So it comes back to that notion of the watchmaker proof of God's existence, right? Because the world is so intricately made that it couldn't have come about by chance. It had to have been designed by a watchmaker. Now, you can argue with this or whatever, but it's a traditional argument for the existence of God.
We're meant to think about that here.
Exactly. He is a kind of God. He is a God who is American, it turns out, as the bit in the cold open says. And he doesn't want to play that role, but we can talk about that in a second. But yeah, so you have a literal watchman, a watchmaker who has made himself as the watch, who is also the watchmaker, who is trained as a watchmaker, and then who serves this role as a watchman, as a guard. And then you get the question of who watches the watchman. It's watches all the way down.
It absolutely is.
And then this, you know, determining metaphor of we're ticking closer to midnight. Like, it's the book keeps doing that. It's everything is so layered.
It's very layered. And when you think about the ways in which Dr. Manhattan relates to the Ozymandias character, again, we're really meant to understand that relationship and that contradistinction again in terms of time. There's a neat moment that happens. I think this is book 11, when we're getting, things are sort of coming to a head and we're with Ozymandias and we now understand what his plan is. And this is in the deluxe edition, it's page 352, 53. So in chapter 11, it's page 4 and 5 of the comic. And so this is when he's kind of getting ready to all have everything come to a head. And he's like, I've been waiting for an opportune moment, but there's no point putting things off any longer and no time like the present. And then he wants this amazing wildcat beast he has that accompanies him. He says, not coming any further. Fair enough. You wait there. This won't take a moment. And so just all that language of, like, I guess, trivial time, you know, the way we refer to time in everyday speech, is doing this weird kind of work there because it's leading up to the apocalyptic moment. And in that way, Ozymandias is sort of like similar to, in some ways, Dr. Manhattan. They both kind of have this really fraught relationship to time, but they're inhabiting it in totally different ways. I thought that was so cool.
Absolutely. Did you like any of the characters?
The only one I found really kind of engaging, I think, was Dr. Manhattan. I found everybody else kind of annoying.
Yeah.
I mean, just because he's such an interesting subject in terms of where he stands.
So I think one of the interesting threads about this is that you've got these superheroes from the old days, from the 30s and 40s, and they're a very wild group of people. Like, they're people who like dressing up in costumes and fighting crime. And so, as you might imagine, as you know, it reveals is the case, they're weird in different ways, or weird may be the wrong term, but some of them are, you know, queer. There are both gay and lesbian and, I guess, other types of queer people in that group. And yet at some point, as we get into the 40s and 50s, that becomes less allowable. So there's this tremendous purge. The lesbian couple is kicked out of the group and then murdered. The gay male superhero commits suicide, I believe, in order to prevent his secret from getting out. Like, really terrible stuff. But you get the sense of all of the sense of sort of the American way that's being defended by the remaining superheroes getting narrower and narrower to the point when they meet up in the 60s to sort of get the gang going again. And they talk about what they're standing for and what they want to fight out. Like, it's awful.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
they're alt-right is how we might describe it today. It's this worse sense of what America means, and they are fully embracing it. And I find it fascinating to think about, like, that side of things along with what these superhero characters are like and what they're capable of and what their interests are and how alienated they are from everyday people and why everyday people in the book trust them less and less over time. In other words, I think not liking the characters has an interesting political function in the book. I'm not sure I can fully explain it properly, Like, I was thinking a lot about why are these characters so unlikable, and it seemed to be doing a lot of work or a lot of commentary in terms of what is going on in the book and what the book's politics are.
Yeah, like, I don't, not that I think she's a likable character, but Lori, who's Silk Spectre II, I think, she has these conversations with Dr. Manhattan that are about, isn't there a value in human life, in human experience? Isn't there something worth saving here, right? And like, it's not that the characters are particularly likable, but that question, that whole debate about what is there something worth saving in humanity? Is there something that's valuable? Like that whole conversation was oddly compelling. And it's one I think we have seen in other kinds of settings, you know, from like, I don't know, 1960s Star Trek down to the present.
Yeah. She manages to convince Dr. Manhattan that there is something worth saving or attending to, let's say.
Yeah, she brings him back.
But did you buy that conversion?
Well, you know, you kind of knew it was coming, like it had to happen.
Yeah.
So I kind of like, you know, it's like when you're watching, I don't know, well, usually when you're watching a James Bond movie, right, you're like, well, nobody's going to kill James Bond, right? Because,
yeah,
you know, he has to always live, right? It's the same kind of thing. You're like, you know, she's going to persuade him to come because obviously he has to come back to Earth, right? Because obviously we have to like, can't hang out on Mars for the whole rest of the book, right? But so there's like, so you know it's going to happen. So I don't know if I found it persuasive on an emotional level, but that problem I found really compelling. Like in other words,
I agree.
Is humanity worthwhile? You know, good question.
Yeah. It's in a sense, like, in a sense, the authors have done the philosophical trick of finding the hardest person to convince of this. Like they've done a thought experiment in creating the person least likely to be convinced of this and then tried to convince him. And obviously for plot reasons, it has to work. But whether the argument is satisfying for a reader who may be inclined naturally to think, yeah, of course, there's got, you know, I'm a human, I'm definitely worth it. And yet you read this and you think, I don't fully buy that he would have been converted by this.
Yeah. Well, that's the Rorschach test, right? I mean, I was so struck by the way in which the smiley face image appears throughout the book. Mm-hmm. You know, you get it right at the beginning, you get it at the end too, right? And that is itself also a weird kind of, you know, you can see it two ways, right? I think that with the smiley face image that appears in these different crucial moments and the constant reminder of the Rorschach test image, this question of like, how do you see things? Do you see things like this or do you see things like that? I think we as readers are being constantly put in that position of having to decide what it is we're seeing and what future we can imagine. And that's the very 80s flavor, I think, of this. You know, where are we going?
Where have we been and where are we going? Yeah.
Yeah. That was very much part of that time.
So we read this as part of our history cluster, and I think it really had some interesting things to say about how history functions and some really intriguing ways of expressing history or telling history, as we talked about. I'm curious, as always, what other books were we thinking of having in this cluster?
Well, one book I had really seriously thought about is a book, I don't know if you've read it. I read it years ago and loved it. Michael Chabon's The Yiddish Policeman's Union. Have you ever read that?
I haven't. I've heard good things about it, but I haven't read it.
I read it not long after it came out, which must have been like 2007 or 8, and absolutely loved it. I very rarely have this experience when I read a book where I get to the end and I immediately turn back to the beginning and start reading it again. This is one of the very rare books where that happened. And it was because I think it was the first time I had run across a counterfactual history book in this story where it's basically a detective story, sort of a like, you know, gumshoe type detective story that's set in the present moment. So it's set around 2007, 2008. But it imagines a world where instead of World War II and the Holocaust having played out the way they did, instead being a world where something slightly different happened because of the death of a guy called Anthony Diamond, who was the Alaska Territory delegate to the U.S. Congress. He was in a car accident, and therefore he wasn't there to argue that Jewish people shouldn't be accepted into the U.S., right? And he argued against this plan to resettle people escaping Nazi Germany in Alaska, right? So because he died, that plan went forward. And so a lot of people who historically were lost survived, and there's this like rich colony of like, you know, Jewish people in Alaska, right? And so whole lot of other stuff is different too. But like, I remember the first time I read it, I was like, it blew my mind. It's like, oh, wow. Like it really opened the door into counterfactual history for me. And so I think it's a really good book. I think a lot of people like it, but for me, it was particularly moving because it was the first time I'd ever thought through like, oh, wow, what would that be like?
Neat.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really good.
I will have to check it out someday. It'll go on the pile of thousands and thousands of books that I need to read.
I know.
The two texts that I was thinking of, one of them is a very short text, and we couldn't have used it for an entire episode, although it is delightful. It's a comic. It's another comic by Richard McGuire called Here. It was originally published as a 6-page comic in Raw magazine, which was an 80s magazine of experimental comics edited by Art Spiegelman, who wrote Mouse, and Françoise Mouly, who is his partner, but also a completely fantastic person in her own right and gets overshadowed too much by him. It is very much like the Dr. Manhattan chapter of this book in the sense that it is constantly jumping from time period to time period. But you have to imagine that the camera, so to speak, is positioned absolutely still.
Yeah, I was going to say you're in one place. You shared this with me and I was like, this is the best thing ever.
It's so good. You're in one place and then you're jumping forwards and backwards through time. And the panels are getting more and more carved up. Like the panel is always the same size. It's always the same sort of square shape, but it gets divided and each of the divisions has a little box telling you what year it takes place in. So this is in the 1985 one, but this is 18,000 BC, and this is 2122, and this is 1975. And so you see this house, this home, get built, get destroyed, get rebuilt, have different people move in, different generations growing up, have an endless amount of housework done within it, the land getting purchased from, you know, it's taking place in the US, so the land is getting purchased from the indigenous peoples.
Purchased.
Well.
Yeah, but exactly, yeah.
I forget what the exact details are of that those frames, but.
But yeah, like all this stuff is going on. Sometimes it's just one moment, sometimes it's two, three, as many as four. And there are these weird resonances. It's very synesthetic, right? It's almost like harmonies or resonances between what's happening in one frame and another within the box, but then also across boxes sometimes, especially in the last section of it. It's really wild.
Yeah, it gets more and more complicated as it goes along. And then it is as close as you're going to get to being able to see through time.
Yeah. If you want to be Dr. Manhattan, this is the thing to read.
And it takes something that's completely pedestrian and makes it rich. And, you know, just by exploring the entire history of this one location, it just unpacks a whole world of resonances and experiences and history. It's fabulous.
Well, it invites us to get outside of linear time, right? And in Watchmen, we understand that as like the weird freakish property of this one character, Dr. Manhattan. Here, it invites us to imagine we could all see it that way.
So the other book that I was thinking of, which we couldn't do because it's very out of print. It's very hard to get your hands on a copy. Libraries have it, but also I haven't actually read it. I picked it up at one point, borrowed it from a library, read a little bit of it and meant to come back to it later and haven't had a chance to do that yet. It's called Subscript by an author named Christine Brooke Rose. Hmm. She is a British writer who wrote some very experimental novels. She lived for most of the 20th century, passed away in 2012. And Subscript is the story that begins about 4.5 billion years ago.
Yeah, wow.
Inside a chemical reaction. And we follow a little sort of bit of chemicals that becomes a cell, a prokaryote cell, and then a eukaryote cell, and then a multicellular organism. And that's like the first chapter. Mm-hmm. And it ends a few thousand years before the invention of writing.
That's so weird.
So it's telling the story of the evolution of humanity in the world, but like without characters.
Hmm. That sounds very weird.
It is incredibly weird. It's a very strange book. It's a very divisive book. Some people really love it. Some people, I think, find it incredibly difficult to read. It's very ambitious. I find her to be a fascinating writer, a very difficult and challenging writer, but one that I always want to read more of. And I feel like I have not read enough of it. And I want to let the world know more about her. But it is impossible to get this book.
Have you read other things by her?
I have. I've read several other books of hers. The one that I enjoyed the most was a sort of children's book called Zorandor. So X-O-R-A-N-D-O-R, in which some kids meet up with a robot. I don't know if I can explain it much more beyond that, but it was a sort of charming book. Let's see, the little description is Jip and Zab, twin brothers, discover a mysterious stone which functions like a large computer, which they name Xorandor.
Wow.
Yeah, she's done some weird stuff. She's really interesting. I need to read more of her. I wish somebody would put more of her work back into print. Listeners, if there are other books that you think we should have considered for this history cluster, please write it and tell us. You can email us at spouter@megaphonic.fm, or you can hit us up on Twitter at @thespouter. And if you tell us a little bit about why you would have liked a particular book to be on our list, we might read it in the next episode. So please get those to us. It's always great to hear what other people are thinking about. And history is such a wide open topic.
Mm-hmm.
So make them good. Make them really compelling choices. I want to be wowed. Because after all, what are we reading next?
We are reading a really out of the box kind of choice. We're reading the Hereford Map, which is kind of a book. Kind of in a way. But it's a really neat way, I think, of continuing to think about temporality in history, because a map allows you to understand time in a very different way from the linear narrative of a chronicle. And yet at the same time, they're really intimately connected. So I'm like so excited to talk about that.
And this isn't just like a map, right? This is a medieval map that it contains a lot of detail.
It has everything.
Yeah.
Because that's what those were for. They're map of the world, right? They're meant to be utterly capacious.
Yeah. A conceptualization of the world brought out in all its details.
With labels on different locations that were meant to kind of almost be, as it were, like hot links, almost, that would summon up knowledge that came from other kinds of books. So they're meant to be a really intertextual way to give you a door into the past.
I'm very excited about this. It'll be a real tricky episode.
But, it'll be fine.
I'm looking forward to it. Until then, if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at spouter@megaphonic.fm, or we're on Twitter at @thespouter. We'd love to hear from you. Show notes with links for anything we've mentioned in this episode are at megaphonic.fm/spouter/49. And the Spouter Inn is one of the fancy little podcasts over at Megaphonic FM. So until next time.
See you again at the Spouter Inn.